History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that really should not go untold. We've learned that they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. And what can we do about it? Well, first of all, we can take a little initiative and ask a few questions. And then invest some time to patiently listen as stories that may have been buried for a long, long time take on new life in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. Did you know that March 25th is National Medal of Honor Day? We're going to hear from another Medal of Honor recipient soon on Hometown Heroes, but not today. If you'd like to learn more about those who have earned our country's most prestigious military decoration, go to medalofhonorday.com. I have that linked for you also at hometownheroesradio.com. But it's another annual observation that we're going to make the focus of our show today because you'll have a few days to look into events in your area commemorating National Vietnam War Veterans Day. Since 2017, that special day has been marked every year on March 29th. If you go to VietnamWar50th.com, you can search for events in your area. In a bit, we're going to meet a Vietnam veteran sharing his experiences from a half century ago. But one thing Hometown Heroes listeners have learned over the years is that the factors that would eventually lead to the war in Vietnam were unfolding long before America's military officially arrived, and even a decade before the French were forced out of Dien Bien Phu. George Wicks served in the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, during World War II, that of course the predecessor to the CIA, and in giving us a snapshot of the OSS's contributions to Allied victory in World War II, Wicks gave us a portrait of the first American casualty in Vietnam, way back in the 1940s.
My commanding officer in Saigon, Peter Dewey, parachuted into France and met up with some resistance. This was all planned. You see, they had communicated beforehand. This is an OSS operation. He and a few others, one of them was the son of Ernest Hemingway, who parachuted in with a fly rod because he was going to live on the trout of France.
Now, what would a modern literature professor know about Ernest Hemingway, though?
You can't help it. Might know too much about Ernest Hemingway. They captured a German staff car and drove around in it, I don't know how they managed this, for a considerable period, sending information back. Now, this is just before the invasion from North Africa, the invasion of southern France. They obtained information about activities on the Rhine, all kinds of information. This is just one little operation.
And this would become your boss, your commanding officer, yes. Dewey. So you're saying that particular mission, one thing that he did and spearheaded, informed the invasion of Europe.
Yes, yes. And that's the kind of intelligence gathering operation that they did during the war. And I've just been reading a book about the invasion, the D-Day, preparation for the D-Day by a French organization that fed information to MI6 in London. They gave them all kinds of information about German submarine bases, for instance, and the development of the rockets in Northern Europe. So this kind of intelligence was terribly important for any large-scale military activity or even small-scale military activity.
Important and also extremely dangerous. And how was it that you came to work with Dewey? When did you first meet him?
I met him in Rangoon. You know, one of the guys in the message center said, there's somebody here who's going to lead the mission to Saigon, and you ought to interview him. So I did. I went to Major Dewey, as he was then. He's always referred to as Colonel Dewey because he became a colonel overnight, the way OSS people did. I became a lieutenant then, you see. I said, I would like to go to Saigon with you. I studied the language. He was unimpressed. He said, yes, but do you know French? And I said, French is my first language. All right, he said, what is the French word for street? So I said, rue. He said, all right, you can go. Turn up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And when I turned up at 3 o'clock in the morning, he pinned lieutenant's bars on me. And then I started impersonating an officer, for which I was cashiered many months later when the Army found out about it.
So your test for promotion was pronouncing one word correctly, and probably a lot of people failed that test.
Well, I don't think he gave that test to very many people. Peter Dewey, who spoke faultless French himself, was looking for French speakers on his mission, and he'd gone all over the theater looking for French speakers, hadn't had much success, because we were going to be dealing with the French in Indochina. So it was essential that some of us at least be able to speak the language.
Well, and I think today, if you just say the word Vietnam, people instantly think of the 60s and maybe the 70s. Folks might go back to the 50s and know about some of the things that happened there. But not too many people realize that all of that was set up by what happened there at the end of World War II. And you were a piece of this. So when you talk about the mission that Dewey was going to be on, what was that mission that you eventually became a part of?
OSS had a mission to Saigon and another to Hanoi to cover what was going on. Now, this was gathering political intelligence rather than military intelligence because there was no State Department representation in all of Southeast Asia, and we were a kind of advanced team sent to report back to Washington on whatever was happening, and also to look after American interests. But I always felt that our chief purpose really was to report on the political situation. And Saigon, for instance, was a hub of intrigue. There were Chinese and Cambodian, and there were all kinds of people, operatives there. It's sort of like a movie set. If you've seen The Quiet American, you have a sense of what, that's a very good, Graham Greene was there 5 months after we were, and he describes it perfectly. Hanoi was under the control of the Vietnamese. They were really, and they were setting up their own government. Ho Chi Minh declared independence from Hanoi. Well, OSS mission in Hanoi was in daily touch with him. They were very close. And one of my friends in the Vietnamese group was in the jungle with Ho while the war was still going on because they were in action against the Japanese, guerrilla action.
And you would have some personal interaction with him as well. What precipitated that, and what was the purpose of your meeting with Ho Chi Minh?
Well, I didn't meet with Ho Chi Minh until later. This is a mission that another guy and I cooked up. I should explain that I spent 4 months in Saigon, and then our commanding officer was killed, and we all were interviewed, signed depositions, and I signed myself, name and rank, and theater headquarters, when it heard this, who is this Lieutenant Wicks? So that's when I was cashiered. And OSS, to save face and my face as well, called me back to our theater headquarters in Singapore, where the commanding officer said, now, where would you like to go next? I can offer you Batavia, Jakarta, or Bangkok. Well, I knew I wanted to go to Bangkok. And so I went to Bangkok for 6 wonderful weeks. I got there in a peculiar fashion. The legation, as it was then, the first State Department representation in Bangkok was beginning. Wasn't anywhere in Vietnam or anywhere else, I think, in Southeast Asia. Anyhow, so they wanted to ship an old Plymouth painted in olive drab camouflage for use by the embassy. No American cars did Bangkok at this time. They loaded it on a freighter, a tramp steamer, and loaded me on too, and that was my mission, to escort this car. Well, tramp steamers are trafficking all along the way. This one stopped off in Saigon, what do you know, for Christmas. And I saw my old friends, one of them and I, cooked up this mission of going to Hanoi. We wanted to go to Hanoi to see what was going on. We sent a message back. He was a major, so he had pull. I sent a message back to OSS Washington about going to Hanoi to interview Ho Chi Minh and see if he was a communist. Well, I mean, everyone, of course, knew that Ho Chi Minh was a communist. In retrospect, I think, because there was no, the OSS mission to Hanoi had ended in October. This is, by this time, we're at the end of December. And I think OSS Washington wanted to know what was going on in Hanoi, this new government forming and all that. So they said, yes, you go to Hanoi and ask Ho Chi Minh if he's a communist, which we did eventually. But I had to go from Bangkok with a radio operator up to Hanoi, and Frank went from Saigon to, well, anyhow, we met up in Hanoi and spent some time there and watched the French arrive in Hanoi in the beginning of the war there, in fact.
Was that the extent of your interview with Ho Chi Minh? Are you a communist? Yes, and see you later?
He said, yes, I'm a communist. Well, the second question was, will your country be communist? Because this is the time when this country, the Cold War, was one of the things that shocked me when I got back to the U.S. after the war, was how hysterical the country was about communism. And that had a lot to do, by the way, with what happened in our relations with Ho Chi Minh.
Well, and I guess that's a question that seems obvious, is here in the 1940s, could you see something coming down the road? Did you have any idea or any inclination that America would end up getting involved in that part of the world because of the way things were going?
No, and it was insane. It was particularly insane after the Vietnamese beat the French army at Dien Bien Phu. You could see that a military campaign such as this country would conduct wouldn't work against a population and an entire population that wanted its independence. We understood a lot of this, but convincing Washington was another matter. We could see a lot of what was coming, and all of us in OSS were sympathetic with the Vietnamese desire for independence.
You won't find the name of A. Peter Dewey on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C., because the Defense Department has ruled that war did not begin for the U.S. in Vietnam until November 1955, after the fall of Dien Bien Phu. But Dewey was killed there a decade before that. It was September 26, 1945. George Wicks remembers that time period with incredible clarity.
Peter Dewey was supposed to go home. He, in those days, at the end of the war, if you had enough points, as they called it, enough years, days, actions, whatever, overseas service, you were released for a discharge. He was supposed to go home on a particular day, and the plane didn't turn up in time. So we drove cross-country from the airport to the villa where OSS guys were living, through a roadblock, and by this time there'd been skirmishing on the outskirts of Saigon, and the Vietnamese were armed, through a roadblock which was manned by Vietnamese, armed Vietnamese. Going through this roadblock, Peter Dewey yelled something in French at the Vietnamese. Now, one of our officers had been wounded the night before, and he had just visited that man in the hospital. He may have yelled something. The officer who was riding with him didn't understand French, so he doesn't know what Peter said. Well, the Vietnamese reaction was they had a machine gun, and they killed him, shot his head off. The Jeep overturned, and it's only incredible luck and some skill that allowed Dewey's second-in-command, Blücher, to get to the villa. He was, I don't know the exact distance. Some accounts is 500 yards. I doubt that he would have sprinted 500 yards. He happened to be that thing, which I am not at all, a crack shot with the 45. And he had one, of course, as an officer. So he made it. Then we were, you know, we had a firefight on our hands for several hours. We were able to drive off the attackers. And finally, they raised a white flag. They wanted to collect their injured and they wanted to collect their casualties and retire from the field. There were only three of us shooting, I think. But we were trained soldiers. And we were using the weapons we'd been trained with, you know, a carbine. Looks like a nice little thing. I don't know if you've ever fired one, but it's very effective. You don't need a major weapon in a firefight like that. The Vietnamese were not trained as soldiers. They were just a bunch of guys who were opposing French occupation of their country.
By the same token, Master of the Obvious here says your life was in severe danger in that moment. Is that something you lived with all the time or that you had to be prepared for? When a situation like that actually comes up, what's that like to be a part of it?
From the time I went into the Army, and I think this is probably true of many of us, I wondered, first of all, if I was going to survive this war, and then what I would do in combat. This was my only experience of combat. I had been in dangerous situations, but not in actual gunfight. And when it happened, I knew exactly what I had to do. You know, I went up to the front of the property, lay down on the ground, with my carbine, enough ammunition. It was natural. It was sort of almost, I won't say instinctive. I thought it out, and I thought the front of the property is the best place to be. You see most clearly, and lying down on the ground, you don't have the problem of unsteady hands shaking or whatever. So the three of us were able to drive off, I don't know how many attackers, but a number, considerable number, and they had pretty heavy casualties and finally called it off.
And then did you have to get out of there after that because of what had happened?
When the attack began, the officer in charge wanted to send the message to us. Our radio communication was always with OSS headquarters in Ceylon. The broadcasts were made at fixed times and always in code, but in this case, couldn't meet the schedule. They decided, I was not a part of this since I was down there on the ground shooting, but decided not to send messages and couldn't send messages. I was a code guy, so there was nobody to encode the messages. And anyhow, send them in the clear and don't try to raise Ceylon because it's not the time they're listening. So send it to the British instead. And the British sent out a troop of Gurkha, a squad of Gurkhas who appeared, but all the action was over by the time they arrived. One of our officers and a French officer who happened to have been there for lunch that day, but he'd also been in the OSS, interestingly enough. He'd been living in Washington, and he joined the OSS first and then later transferred to the French Army. They went and met with the Vietnamese. They wanted to get the Jeep and Dewey's body. Well, both had disappeared and were never found again.
Well, and you're qualified to say that because you were one of the ones searching for him, right?
One of my jobs, subsequently, one of my assignments was examining grisly remains to see if they were Peter Dewey. So we did that for a time. My point is that Frank White, this same guy I went to Hanoi with, and the French officer, Valger, were perfectly safe by then. You know, I give them a lot of credit for going out there and meeting with the Vietnamese after we had been shooting at each other for several hours. But we could have gone back to town. There wasn't any problem. We would have taken the regular road back to town. We wouldn't have gone through the roadblock. So the Gurkhas didn't save us, but they made us more comfortable.
And what about the emotional impact? Because here's a guy who has been your boss, and now he's gone. How did that hit you as a young man far away from home?
Peter and I were quite close. We used to speak French to each other, which none of the other guys did. We had a kind of standing joke. I would greet him in French as mon colonel, and he would greet me as mon lieutenant. He talked to me quite a bit. Well, for one thing, he told me all about what he was picking up in the way of intelligence. And it was very interesting because he was an old hand, and he was very experienced, had terrific connections, and, as I said, spoke faultless French and got around. In fact, that's why he was being sent away. The British didn't like the fact that he was meeting with Vietnamese, particularly Vietnamese active in the independence movement. He talked to me a lot about personal things. You know, what was I going to do after the war? He was thinking of a career in foreign service. I've always thought if Peter Dewey had lived, I would have gone into the foreign service. So I was quite moved by his death. I felt it personally. This was a friend. This was someone I knew quite well and saw on a daily basis for, it'd been 3 months that we'd been together then.
And did his death affect at all your view of your own life and death or your own future if you were going to continue with the OSS or this intelligence work?
I didn't think I was in any danger after that. I mean, once we got back to the Continental Hotel in the center of Saigon, we went on with our radio communications, and the radio operator and I had our own little place in the annex next to this very sinister character who owned the hotel, Frank Heaney. He was a Corsican who was in the opium business, and he was very friendly. He was always friendly with me because I spoke French. The radio operator didn't. He always invited me to come in and have a pipe with him. It was a real sort of Graham Greene operation, you know. And Graham Greene, when he came to Saigon, soon met up with Frank Heaney and talked with him for hours, fascinated by this man who knew all kinds of underground things, you know, the opium trade and whatnot.
And I'm sorry if any of my questions border on cliche or a generic view or interpretation of things, but did you ever feel like the man who knew too much or could end up knowing too much because of some of these circles you were running in or the things you were exposed to?
I can answer that with a rather melodramatic bit of information. When I went back to Saigon on that tramp steamer, I learned that I'd had a price on my head. Peter Dewey and I had been marked by the French colonials. They knew we were meeting with the Vietnamese, and I didn't explain that. Peter met with some of the leaders of the Vietnamese independence movement. And since he was well known, he decided he couldn't always meet with them, and he asked me to go and have some of these clandestine meetings because I could speak French with them. They all spoke French. They were all educated men. And two or three times I would get dressed. There were lots of POWs floating around town, mostly Dutch, who hadn't been repatriated yet. And they all wore khakis but with baggy shorts. So I dressed up like a Dutch POW, and in order to walk the streets where I wouldn't be seen, well, the French obviously were on to us, and that's why they had put a price on Peter's head and mine. And they were not very well informed, however. The description of me was really a description of Peter Dewey. He was about 6 inches shorter than me and slightly bald.
Details matter, don't they? Not only did George Wicks make it home, he would go on to a long career as a professor at the University of Oregon. You can find his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. Who knew? The first American casualty in Vietnam came way back in 1945. But if you visit Washington, D.C. today, of course, you'll find more than 58,000 names on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall. When we come back, a story we've never heard before from a man who, like so many Vietnam veterans, had some names that he needed to see on that wall. Friends of his who did not make it home. National Vietnam War Veterans Day is coming up March 29th. Maybe you can attend an event in your area. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.